You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 14th of March 2019 on Monocle 24. Live from Midori House in London, this is the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller. Coming up...
The ayes to the right, 412. The noes to the left, 202. So the ayes have it. The ayes have it. Unlock.
After repeatedly deciding what they don't want, British MPs decide what they do want, and it's more time to think about what they want. We'll attempt to explain another inexplicable day in British politics, and we'll see if we can figure out where this registers on the scale of similar parliamentary upheavals. Later in the show, we'll look at the impact of more normal decision-making on crime. We'll hear from the Committee to Protect Journalists about a new book memorialising journalists killed at work, and...
There reaches a point when maybe each new outrageous statement or outrageous tape dug up has the effect of kind of diminishing returns. You know, people know what they know now about what Tucker Carlson has done and said. Whether any new piece of information is going to change anyone's mind is an open question.
How are people just now noticing that Tucker Carlson is Tucker Carlson? That's all coming up on the Monocle Daily, live from London, starting now. And welcome to tonight's Monocle Daily with me, Andrew Muller. It's possible that tuning into the Daily right now is someone who perceived that 24 hours ago, British politics had clearly reached an unsurpassable apotheosis of insanity and therefore resolved to switch everything off and come back to it a day later, round about now, when everything and everybody had calmed down a bit. Well, we have news for that listener, and it is all bad. Compared with today, yesterday's extraordinary parliamentary shenanigans turn out to have been quite the model of composed discourse and rational, stolid decision-making. Well, I'm joined with more on this by Joy Ladiko, columnist with the Evening Standard. Joy, I've been trying and failing all evening to find ways to sum this up. Happily, somebody else has done it for me, posting on Twitter within the last hour, Yvette Cooper, MP, who I think we can probably describe as shadow leader of the opposition. She said, "We tried to amend the Prime Minister's Article 50 motion today. After we lost, we voted with the Prime Minister for her Article 50 motion. Seemed the responsible thing to do. Now I see the Brexit Secretary who argued against us and for the Prime Minister's motion actually voted against it, and her Chief Whip abstained." She appends that summary with the letters W, T and F. Yvette Cooper, I suspect, speaking for quite a lot of Great Britain this evening. Joy, as far as it's possible to tell, and I think on balance, certain inaccuracies may be forgiven by our listeners. Where the heck are we?
Okay, so yesterday on Tuesday...
Yeah, time has lost all meaning.
Time has lost all meaning. On Tuesday, there was a great big parliamentary day where they decided whether they're going to vote yet again on... It was the second meaningful vote
was
on Theresa
really
May's...
Was that really only on Tuesday?
That was only on Tuesday.
It feels like something that happened in the early 70s.
The second meaningful vote on Theresa May's deal, and she had another thumping defeat on it. I think it was you who mentioned it was the third largest defeat in parliamentary history.
Some have suggested the fourth largest. Anyway, it was big.
It was big. So moving on from that, there was going to be a sequence of votes after that. Yesterday, Parliament voted to take no deal off the table, and it was an incredible kind of day of votes, complete Alice in Wonderland votes. So those two things passed by, and we were expecting that. Today was the day they voted on whether to extend and in what circumstances and how. Now, roughly speaking, what happened is various of the opponents put forward various propositions to kind of try and tweak there were two interesting ones. One is the people's vote, which was put forward by Sarah Wollaston this evening, and it was heavily defeated. But that doesn't necessarily mean it will in future be heavily defeated.
Because as we are learning, things that are heavily defeated can come back and have another crack.
So Sarah Wollaston is now one of the independents. What's happened is the Labour Party said, Keir Starmer, their Brexit secretary, said, look, in principle, we support this, but now is not the time to support it. The other really big vote this evening was Hilary Benn, who's a very prominent member of the Labour Party, but not really a Corbynista, who brought forward a proposition that if Theresa May's third attempt at passing her deal, this so-called meaningful vote, which is becoming less and less meaningful, if she failed at doing that, Parliament would then take control and start having what they call indicative votes, i.e. try and work out what the House of Parliament, the House of Commons itself would vote for. And that was defeated by a margin of 2, which meant that if had one person voted the other way, John Bercow, the Speaker, would have been the casting vote.
Which would have been the only thing even sillier than what actually happened today.
Which was?
Well, I mean, what you've just described.
Well, it was all fairly chaotic. Basically, none of the amendments passed. So Theresa May then puts her original idea to the people, which is to the Commons, which is basically we will have an extension, which will be a 3-month extension. If next week you vote for my deal, and if not, it's going to be a much longer extension. What this means is that everybody who's planning either a party or commiserations on March 29th should now just hold off on their drinks orders, because it looks pretty likely that the UK is now going to go to the EU and ask for an extension. And the question now is it a long one or a short one?
Or, even more amusingly, is there going to be one? Because the EU collectively could be forgiven, I think, for having pretty much run out of patience at this point. Is there any chance? Because the thing, and it has to be, correct me if I'm wrong, but this has to be unanimously agreed by the EU. If one malcontent member of the European Union just decides, you know what, I'm done with these people, I don't want to listen to any more of this, or if perhaps one member of the European Union says, all right, we'll go along with it, but we want this big rock, which is attached to the south coast of our country,
just to go away.
Yeah.
It's really boring. We're fed up of hearing about Brexit. So they should all fall into line. There is one sort of minor theme that's beginning to rumble away, is that Nigel Farage went over to Italy to speak to Salvini to try and persuade the Italians to block our request for an extension. And this was put to him, and he said, yes, I am lobbying for people to use their veto on our extension.
Nigel Farage acquiring a sudden enthusiasm for European leaders overruling the British Parliament.
Absolutely. And it is, I think, possibly one of the greatest acts of treachery I've ever heard. The idea that one of our own MEPs is actually trying to send us over the cliff edge. There was also an interesting question being raised about Ian Duncan-Smith, who is a Conservative, not a UKIPper like Farage, and Owen Paterson, who popped over to Poland last week, supposedly for war graves, and people started asking questions as to whether they too were lobbying the Polish government to veto the extension. Now, if that does happen, we are suddenly in actually a crisis, not just for the UK, but also the EU, because we are then, both sides then forcing no deal, which is pretty disastrous for both of them.
Possibly a silly question, although this feels like a night on which there aren't any sensible ones, but do we have the least idea what the nominal opposition is actually doing? Actually, possibly a better question is, does the opposition have any idea what the opposition is doing?
Well, you see, I'm of the opinion that Keir Starmer is a little bit of a genius, and I understand that he was actually perfectly happy today with how procedure went, because what it's done is...
He's one of the other shadow opposition leaders.
He's the shadow Brexit secretary. So his counterpart on the government benches, Stephen Barclay, who'd been arguing for the extension literally at the dispatch box at 6:55. At 7 o'clock they go into vote and he goes and votes against the government. Keir Starmer has been playing this very simple, straightforward line, saying we have to go through this stage by stage by stage, and the first thing we need to do is make sure that we've got an extension on the table, and then we need to begin to discuss what the viable options are. And he, at the moment, he has had a plan for about 2 years, and it's sort of ticking off the boxes as they go along. Jeremy Corbyn, who has been much criticised all the way through, seems to also have begun to find his voice, and he's still pushing for his customs union deal, which can't get through because you'd have to open up a whole new round of negotiations. But because we've now got this extension, we are now slightly into the territory where we can reopen negotiations in certain circumstances. The EU27 aren't going to just reopen that withdrawal agreement, but there would have to be a significant shift, like a general election, second referendum, or Parliament all voting for one thing that could trigger another round of talks.
Just finally, on the subject of politicians who have been thwanging repeatedly at one drum for the last 2 years, to return to the Prime Minister, Theresa May, is it possible, and this was a theory floated by Tim Marshall on Midori House earlier this evening, that she might actually get her deal up, the twice heavily defeated withdrawal agreement? If the thinking being, if the EU come back and say, sure, you can have an extension, it's 2 years, that she would then be able to take that back to all but the most obdurate Brexiter headbangers and say, look, you all understand that a 2-year extension means this is never going to happen. So your choices are take the deal, and at least you have got the UK out of the EU, and it's then presumably all to play for, or bin it, it's over.
Well, that is kind of the gameplay at the moment. So Donald Tusk is basically saying 21 months, 21 months, 21 months, and once you enter 21 months, the Remainers and the very soft Brexiteers are getting quite happy because they can see this new space for a negotiation, or you know, the ability to put forward completely fresh plans. And the ERG at that point are thinking, we're never ever going to get any form of Brexit. So come next week, they're all being persuaded to move over to Theresa May's position. The Attorney General has also given a tiny piece of new advice on the Vienna Convention, which, I mean, they're already knocking out. it's almost too nerdy to even discuss it. So what they're doing is, the term is, they're kind of trying to create ladders for the ERG and the DUP, the Northern Ireland ruling party, to climb down on. So it is possible they will get a certain number, but there are also a certain number of total hardcore lunatics in the ERG who will vote against everything automatically. They'll vote against their own mother. So I wouldn't yet be convinced that this is going to swing it for Theresa.
Joy Ladeco, thank you. As always, I think it's just about possible we might be discussing this subject again at around this time, one weeknight next week. You are listening to The Daily, live from Studio One at Midori House in London. And as we have been discussing, it has been quite a day in British political history, even if it may take some years yet to figure out quite what happened. It has certainly been the kind of spectacle which has prompted more than one observer to exclaim that they've never seen the like. But even if that is true of us alive in this blessed dawn, any British political tumult has a considerable history of such things to compete with. In an attempt to figure out where this one rates, I'm joined by Christopher Lee, historian and the author of This Sceptred Isle. Christopher, first to that first idea, really, have we ever seen anything remotely like what we've seen in the House of Commons over the last 72 hours or so?
We haven't seen it in this form, and nor could we, really, because, I mean, when you think about it, in modern communications, everybody, if unless they can hide somewhere, is going to get the full blast of exactly what's going on. They'll get all the opinions. And one night, somebody mentioned to me on College Green, where people gathered to be interviewed, and said the average take-up on College Green last week was somewhere in the region of 96 MPs in the evening. I mean, no wonder they weren't voting for each other. I mean, they're all on College Green, quite clearly. So we won't see it because, times are different. But Parliament's never been a quiet place. It's never been a place where people just got on with it, and there've been big issues. I mean, the 19th century, for example, the big difference was that we were the superpower, so therefore you weren't going to get involved with, unless it was on the battlefield, with, you know, with the French or the Dutch or the Germans and another 25 countries. So when you get Peel with his great speeches about the Corn Laws in the 1840s especially, these were vicious debates. People were called horrible things. And in fact, he lost about two-thirds of his party. They went and joined these sort of, I suppose it was the Brexit group of the day. and they really did. And they actually sort of defected from the party. And these were very damaging things, but they weren't like this because these guys knew what they were doing, whereas the impression with this lot that they're not so sure.
Well, that does prompt the next question I wanted to ask, which is one of the distinguishing features of what we're witnessing is the more or less complete collapse of party discipline on both sides of the aisle at the same time. Is there any precedent for that you can think of?
Well, not in the same way. I mean, when Grey introduced his Reform Act in 1831, there was a defection. It was almost like a civil war. I mean, people who were MPs in the same family didn't talk to each other, walked out on each other. And there was a sense, though, that it would go through eventually. But that was because everybody thought it was about something else. And it was about independence, which there is this sense in this, isn't there? There's a sense of independence. We're not living with that lot again. We're going off to do things as we used to do. But this was the destruction of the monarchy. They thought that if you reform Parliament, you reform the way we govern each other and who can govern and who can vote, and etc., that is actually turning around and saying, well, we don't actually acknowledge the monarch as the person, not just the monarchy, but the person that we have to say yes and no to, and joyously so. And so there were bigger issues. But what we have got right the way through from even something as early as that, the 1820s, before Victoria came to the throne, we have a sense that on one side there was an argument, on the other side there was an argument, and you knew that if you stood on that side of the gangway, you were all going to speak with the same tongue. What is quite distinguished now is there has never been a time when so many different people would swap sides, government would break up and then come back together, and there would be a sense that people have abandoned, and I'm not quite sure I'm quite right about this, but nobody got a sense that they actually abandoned their prime minister and said, right, you know, you're on your own. We're going to, as a parliament, sort it out ourselves. And that probably didn't happen until just before the First World War.
Do you subscribe at all to, I think, the quite common idea that we are witnessing right now, that politicians of historically low caliber, or is it just that this is an average parliament which has been confronted with an astonishingly complex and divisive problem?
Well, that's true, but I tried something. It dawned on me watching this. I've been sitting night after night just watching this whole thing and watching the debates. When we had the first debate about the deal, and I sat there with, in front of me, the 585 pages or whatever it is, 86 pages, sat there. And I started flicking through paragraph by paragraph. And I listened to the debate. Nobody, apart from Ireland, nobody actually gave in a speech what was in this particular paragraph, what was in that on that particular page. And they were therefore discuss it. They were all discussing almost as if they were challenging the Prime Minister as a personal thing. But they didn't actually get into the document itself. Now, that would never have happened in even quite recently past times. It certainly wouldn't have happened in 1975 with, you know, when we were rethinking how we were going to live within the EU. It certainly wouldn't have happened earlier than that when Hugh Gaitskell, the leader of the Labour Party, said, if we do this, we give away 1,000 years of history, and people got up and shouted at him. Now, that's different because they had a point of principle. Two sides had a point of principle. There is a definite sense, compared with all the times before that, 1829, Catholic Emancipation Act, things were thrown at each other, the Irish legislation, 1815, even more stuff, probably the same stuff thrown at each other. 1956, Suez Canal, everybody was really going to sort of take the Prime Minister and throw him out. In fact, he, as you know, Eden went off to the West Indies and was terribly ill and resigned anyway. But what is different with this is that you get a sense that these are not very good people. I don't mean good and bad. They're not actually very good politicians. They're not very good administrators. They're not the sort of people that used to rule you. And I suppose you can actually get to a point where you say, well, yes, of course, we've passed the days when Heseltine, for example, in 76, I think, 76, picked up the mace. Do you remember that thing?
I do.
He picked up the mace and he challenged the opposition. And that was just about pairing. It wasn't that important. But it's the last big thing that anybody did. And there was a sort of aberration in what he did. But there was a sense that there was purpose. And where do you get that sense now? People look at King Clark and say, well, he's the last of the great beasts, last of the big beasts. And of course, it's not the big beasts that eventually win. It's the quiet people that eventually put your parliaments together and keep it going.
Christopher Lee, thank you for joining us. You're listening to The Daily on Monocle 24.
California, here we come. Monocle has arrived on the West Coast. Our new shop and bureau is open at Platform, the design quarter in Culver City, that's home to 100 boutique retail and culinary brands. If you're in town, pop along to meet the team, pick up the latest issue of the magazine and browse our exclusive collaborations. From elegant stationery to smart jackets, plus plenty in the way of print, of course. Discover our range from furniture to fragrances, courtesy of brands from the US and beyond. Intrigued? Then come and see us at our new LA outpost at Platform in Culver City. We look forward to meeting you there.
You're listening to The Daily on Monocle 24. Since 1992, at least 1,337 journalists around the world have been killed doing their jobs. A representative selection of them are commemorated in a new book called The Last Column, published by the Committee to Protect Journalists in association with the Dow Jones Foundation, News Corp and HarperCollins. As the title suggests, The Last Column is a collection of the final dispatches filed by journalists, including Marie Colvin, Tim Hetherington, Jamal Khashoggi and Daniel Pearl. The book is accompanied by a mini-documentary and a programme of global events. Well, I'm joined now by Joel Simon, Executive Director of the Committee to Protect Journalists. Joel, it's such a simple and elegant idea for commemorating journalists, you know, the last things they wrote or photographed, obviously in no knowledge that they would be the last things they wrote or photographed. Where did the idea come from as a way of commemorating them?
Well, actually, we were approached by some friends of the organization who suggested it to us, and we, you know, sort of batted it around internally and said, you know, this is really an exciting idea. It's exciting in the sense that it really allows us to communicate just how critically important and how vital this work is. And also, I think what the other thing that really this book conveys is what is lost when these journalists are gone. There's so many powerful pieces in this volume. You can't help but think, what would we have known if these journalists had lived? What stories might have been told? Those are gone forever. And that's why murder is really the most effective form of censorship, because these voices are lost.
So what are some of the stories that appear in the book? Which were the ones that made the selection?
Well, I think what's so powerful, again, about this approach is that it's such a range. Some of these journalists were global figures like Marie Colvin, who were reporting for a global audience. They really wanted to inform the world through their publication. Some were very, very local journalists like Data Hydera, who was a journalist in the Gambia, a tiny country in West Africa that is just a sliver of a country around the Gambia River that most people can't find on a map, but he was a vital force within his community. And, you know, I was just struck by the range. I mean, I'll mention a few. I think, you know, I think it is worth talking about Marie and her final immortal dispatch of the horror of the widow's basement, the place where families went to take refuge amid the relentless bombing campaign that was taking place. And she died. You know, you said that some of these journalists didn't know that it was their last dispatch. I think Marie had some inkling of just how vulnerable and dangerous she was, and recognized that this might be the last story she wrote, and she really felt compelled to stay and tell that story. And I want to point to another column that really stayed with me. It's the one by Lasantha Wickmarutunga. It wasn't actually his last column. It was a posthumous column because he wrote it knowing that he could be killed. And he wanted to communicate why he had given his life in the event of his death. And I think for all of us who are journalists living in an age in which journalists are disparaged and they're attacked and they're vilified, and we would, you know, we even the level of popular support for the work that we do is not what we would like it to be, to see the words of a journalist who believes so fervently in the profession and in the power of words that he was willing to give his life is just a really poignant reminder of what journalism at its best represents.
I did want to ask about that point, about whether it's your view that that kind of anti-media rhetoric, which we see and hear in various jurisdictions around the world, is actually making life more meaningfully, physically dangerous for journalists. Because, of course, journalists, you're going to get called names by powerful people if you go into this business. But does it become a factor in the actual physical endangerment of journalists?
I think I think yes, and there are several ways in which I think there is evidence to support this. The first is that we've seen record numbers of journalists imprisoned around the world in recent years. This book focuses on journalists who are killed, but of course that's a different kind of threat. And we've also seen a rise in the number of journalists imprisoned on what could be called fake news charges. We've been tracking what we call false news charges for a number of years, but the number of journalists jailed on these charges has increased at a time when we're seeing repressive governments around the world adopt the kind of fake news rhetoric that's favored by President Trump, the way that he criticizes the media. So that suggests that repressive and authoritarian governments and leaders around the world are taking advantage of this kind of rhetorical framing to justify their repressive action. The other thing, the other event that we can point to, and this is something that we did include in the book, is the Jamal Khashoggi murder, the murder of a prominent Saudi dissident journalist, a columnist for the Washington Post, who was killed in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul as part of a state operation, killed and dismembered, allegedly on the orders of the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. He must have done some calculation, you know, or whoever is responsible within the the Saudi leadership that participated and organized this murder must have done some calculation of what the likely consequences might be, because he had to have understood that you know, if this was discovered, there would be repercussions. And I have to say that it's very disappointing to see that the Trump administration has not used the leverage and influence it has to hold the Saudi government responsible. To the contrary, I think that the president, President Trump, has abetted the cover-up of that crime. So I think both of those things send a very disturbing message that actually emboldens violent and repressive forces around the world who seek to silence journalists.
Joel Simon with the CPJ, thank you. You can find out more about The Last Column at the website www.thelastcolumn.com. We're also proud to say that the book will be available to be looked at in Monocle shops, so do check our website and or subscribe to the Monocle Minute for details. You're listening to The Daily. Here are some of the other stories we're following today. Air raid sirens have sounded in Tel Aviv following the apparent launch of two rockets from inside Gaza. It's unclear as we go to air who fired the rockets, although both Hamas and Islamic Jihad have been quick to deny involvement. Israel's military has said that the Iron Dome missile defense system was activated, but that no interceptions occurred. No injuries have been reported. Media in Gaza report the evacuation of Hamas military posts in presumable anticipation of Israeli retaliation. The US Senate has passed a measure which effectively rejects the national emergency declared in February by US President Donald Trump over the situation at the US border with Mexico. 12 senators from Trump's Republican Party voted with the Democratic contingent to revoke Trump's proclamation by a margin of 59 to 41. Trump responded on Twitter with the single word outburst veto! Exclamation mark, rendered in the all capitals, which are the ironclad indicator of a sound mind. It seems unlikely that the two-thirds Senate majority required to override a presidential veto can be wrangled, however, so the non-building of the non-wall in response to the non-crisis will probably continue. And a boffin at Google in Japan has claimed a new world record for calculating the value of pi, the infinitely unspooling patternless figure you arrive at by dividing a circle's circumference by its diameter. Emma Haruka Owayo calculated pi to a length of 31.4 trillion digits, clearing the previous mark by a lazy 9 trillion or so, though we are, of course, taking her word for this. Were one to recite this number out loud at a brisk pace, it would take 3,332,064 years, by which time Theresa May's withdrawal bill might have passed the House on its 110,000th reading. Buzzing. This is the Monocle Daily. Time now for a preview of the next episode of The Menu on Monocle 24. Only a handful of distilleries in the world can claim a unique terroir in their whiskey, and I could try pronouncing that word another seven times, and I'm not going to get there. For generations, the great majority of distillers have used strains of barley that have been cultivated for distilling purposes rather than for flavour. But a talented team at the Victoria Caledonian Distillery in Victoria, Canada, has developed a single malt recipe that involves smoking their own Canadian-grown barley in a custom-made oven, which infuses it with the flavours of the West Coast. Monocle's Darren Steinke stopped into the tasting room to talk to whiskey maker Graham McAloney about his peating process and how it makes his whiskey unique.
Victoria Caledonian Distillery and Trois Dogs Brewery has been open a little shy of 3 years. Nestled in a semi-industrial park on the outskirts of Victoria, Canada, it's not in the traditional brewery district of Victoria, where most of the beer and whiskey tourists pilgrimage to. In fact, you really have to search for the place if you want to have a tour. There are a few patrons at the tasting room bar where hostess Bryn is drawing pints, pouring whiskey, and answering questions. We start where Scottish whiskey began, Islay and Graham's roots.
Turns out my seven greats grandfather was born and grew up in Islay. So way back when I was an Eilich, as the natives of Islay are called. So what better excuse to go make peated whiskey than if you've got genetic roots back in Islay and you happen to like the product as well. So I went back to Islay and actually really studied the process as a fermentation scientist and biochemical engineer. I wanted to look at how do they run that traditional process and can I bring it to Canada using Canadian barley? Because in reality, there are only a handful of distilleries on the planet smoke their own barley. And honestly, they don't make enough of their own peated barley to make all of their peated whiskey, so they still buy in peated barley, right? And part of the issue is that they're trying to germinate the barley, which is a very space and manpower intensive process. And then once they germinate it, they smoke it. Well, if you can cut out the germinating step and let the experts, the maltsters, do that, that means then I can use local Canadian barley from the local maltsters, and then I just need to figure out how to smoke it myself at the distillery. So I went over to Islay, looked at John Campbell at Laphroaig was so generous and let me wander around his plant and spend the day with his maltman. Anthony Wills at Culhoman let me do the same. Took all the measurements, dimensions, all the mad scientist approach, looked at their batch records, just exactly how does the smoking process work. And then I came back. And if you're going to design something in Canada, the best person to do it with, other than being a mad scientist engineer, is a farmer. A prairie farmer, right? Because these farmers out on the prairies, and my cousin's married to a farmer in Alberta, they are the savviest businessmen, but the most practical, hands-on people you'll ever meet. So we gave him the conceptual sketches, and he put together what I think is an absolute masterpiece of a commercial smoking unit. You soak it, the barley, you load 2 metric tons, that's 2,000 kilograms. We load that in, soak it overnight, because it has to be damp for the smoke to stick onto the barley, to absorb onto the barley. Mm-hmm. Drain it the next day, and then we start burning local peat. It's a cold smoking process, and that peat, you can hold your hand above the peat fire, and you will not burn your hand. It's all about getting the right quality of smoke to make a great peated whiskey. And so went and visited a local wood stove manufacturer, Wilk Stoves, you might know them yourself. I think a multi-generational local family that make wood stoves. Got one of their stoves as our peat fire, hooked it up to the smoking unit, soaker smoker, and you smoke it for quite a long while. And the key part of it is to cold smoke while it's still damp. And then eventually you have to dry the barley off, otherwise it could go moldy on you while you're storing it. So we have a big hot air dryer and blow a bunch of hot air up its backside to dry it right down. Now, the beauty of that is we talked about terroir and how I believe that the craft industry will start to infuse more terroir into whiskies that haven't been there previously in any real way. So here's a glorious opportunity for me to go collect different types of peat, right? So I've started off with a kind of heathery, myrtle type bog, right, in this US Northwest, Canadian West Coast region. I've now identified another peat bog that's way up in high montane, close to the Rocky Mountains, and it's a totally different type of moss, right? So as long as I can get this moss out of the ground and dry it off, then I can burn it. And now we can really explore the true essence of terroir. We've only done one campaign of about half a dozen batches, I think it was, of this initial peaty stuff. And it's bloody good, right? I've poured the moonshine, right, four local clubs now, and people are saying, Graham, would you put that into a bottle so I can buy some of it? It's got lots of bonfire, maybe a bit of smoke kipper in there, but then it's still got the house style, right, of the super fruity nose and complexity, unusual complexity in a new make spirit, and a big juicy malt base. But with all of these peat smoke notes overlaid on top of it, it's an amazingly complex whiskey that, other than a little bit of youthfulness, I think a lot of people say, yeah, you could drink that now. Now, you're going to try a sample that's been in wood for only 3.5 months, and I think that you'll be blown away by it when you try it.
That was Graham McAloney of Victoria Caledonian Distillery speaking to Monocle's Darren Steinke. For more food and drink stories, tune into this week's edition of The Menu. It premieres tomorrow, which is Friday at 1900 London time. You can, of course, catch up with that or all our other programming anytime you like after that on our website. You're listening to The Daily. Do stay tuned. You're listening to The Daily on Monocle 24. Now, amidst and despite the circus presently occurring in the House of Commons here in London, intermittent attempts at governance are still being made. Among them was this week's spring statement by the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Philip Hammond, which in less deranged times would have been a subject of great interest, especially his promise of £100 million to underwrite police overtime to tackle knife crime. At least 100 people have been stabbed to death in the UK already this year, though some have argued that the number might have been lower had that money been spent earlier. Well, joining me now is Ian Brennan, a reader in criminology at the University of Hull. Ian, this is a common political row, but is there a definitive causal link between spikes in crime and reduction in public spending, whether it's on police or in other areas?
Good evening. It's a really good question, and it's one that sounds simple, but it's really difficult to sort of clarify and determine. The last week, for example, Theresa May made the suggestion that there was no link between police cuts and serious violence, and then quickly turned around and contradicted herself. And I think really it's you could have made either argument quite convincingly. So in 2009, when we had our last knife crime spike or peak, we had the more police per person than we've ever had in England and Wales. And now, admit it, in the last 10 years, those numbers have dropped considerably, and we're seeing a return to that spike. So it's a really tricky question to answer.
Possibly a better question then is, if you are going to spend £100 million on tackling knife crime, is increasing police overtime necessarily the smartest way to spend it?
That's a great question. There's really convincing evidence that the sort of tactics that police use when they're faced with a big, serious violent crime problem, things like stop and search and what they also call Section 60, where they sort of reduce the standard of suspicion for searches in a particular area or a hotspot for a short period of time. Those sort of tactics that they use, and that's what the £100 million is largely going to be spent on, I suspect, don't seem to have any real effect on violent crime. Studies in the United States, where they've evaluated stop and frisk, and studies in looking at London, have shown that increasing the rate of stop and search doesn't have any impact on violent crime, and arguably has a really bad impact on police-community relations. We saw one of the last sort of big spikes or peaks in stop and search was around the summer of 2011, And that's also the time that we saw the London riots.
Is there and I realise that this is possibly a bit of a Gordian knot, but is there an argument that that lack of trust between communities and police that you spoke about, is that in itself a contributory factor in people carrying knives and other weapons?
There's a theory that basically, if you live in an environment where that's particularly violent, and the state in the form of the police doesn't seem to be doing anything to protect you, there is a rational argument that you're entitled to carry a weapon. I temper that and say it's a bounded rational argument within sort of a context of being under threat. There's an argument that if the police can't protect you, then perhaps carrying a weapon is a necessary thing or is a sensible thing to do. I don't necessarily agree with that, but I can understand a 15-year-old making that decision.
So, but are there better, because obviously the ideal scenario, presumably, in reducing knife violence is reducing the numbers of people carrying knives, and these are crimes in which both the perpetrators and the victims are disproportionately young people. Have we learned any hard and fast lessons over what kind of things dissuade 15-year-olds from carrying a knife with them?
The things that probably dissuade young people from carrying knives are knowing that their friends don't carry knives. There's been a lot of discussion about the impact of social media and the impact of even showing images of the police with the knives that they've confiscated sort of as trophies and suggesting that that actually creates fear in the minds of young people. I don't think that's true. I think particularly young people learn a lot about their environment from a very small number of people and from their own limited experiences of their worlds. So the areas to target are making young people realize that weapon carrying is rare among their peers and also trying to make their environment safer. So some people do carry weapons because of a very real imminent threat to their lives.
Ian Brennan at the University of Hull, thank you for joining us. You're listening to The Daily. Up next, the Asian newspapers.
Download the latest episode of Meet the Writers to join me, Georgina Godwin, as I take you to Hollywood, where we meet essayist, novelist and TV writer Taylor Jenkins Reid. She began her career in film production, switching to writing after being influenced by the actress Jennifer Aniston. For the last 6 years, she's produced a book a year, and her latest, Daisy Jones and the Six, is based on Fleetwood Mac. It's a wild story of the highs and lows of fame. That's Taylor Jenkins Reid giving us an insider view of movies and music in Los Angeles on Meet the Writers, available as a podcast now.
It is time now to take a look at the Asian newspapers. We're joined once again by John Everard, former UK ambassador to North Korea, among other bailiwicks. We do start, John, with a story here being reported in the South China Morning Post, but everywhere else, it seems redundant to call a story attached to North Korea bizarre because they always are. But this one has been way up there. This is the saga of the two women charged with the murder of the half-brother of Kim Jong-un in Kuala Lumpur Airport.
That's right. One of whom was released on Monday. Released because the prosecutors simply dropped the charges against her. No explanation. She simply walked free. She was Indonesian. And the other woman, a Vietnamese, had reasonably thought that she too might be released shortly. But no, it turns out that today the Malaysian prosecutors have said that she must stand trial. They have paused the trial proceedings because she's so upset, understandably again. They'll resume on the 1st of April, where she will for the first time give testimony. I think the big difference, though, between them is that the Indonesian woman who was released doesn't seem actually to have applied the nerve agent to Kim Jong-nam. If you watch the CCTV of what happened in that airport concourse, it's the Vietnamese woman who goes up and puts a cloth impregnated with VX on his face. The Indonesian simply stands aside.
So they're trying to simplify this case then, by the look of it?
They're trying to simplify it, or perhaps they simply decided they didn't have enough evidence to convict the Indonesian woman. Another thing, of course, is 2 years just elapsed. Had they worked out that even if she were found guilty, association with the murder would probably have only got her a couple of years, so they might just let her walk free.
Moving along to NDTV, this is a strange one. This is the United States finding another reason to get angry with China. But you can kind of see America's point here. This is China keeps blocking attempts to blacklist Masood Azhar, the alleged chief of Jaish-e-Mohammed, a Pakistani-supported militant organisation, as a global terrorist. Why would China object to that? What's in it for them?
Almost certainly because Pakistan has asked them to object. The relationship between Jaish Mohammed and Masood Azhar personally and Pakistan is a bit murky, but I think we'd all agree that it'd be very difficult to see how they could, for example, have carried out the attack on 14th of February, the one that killed 40 Indian paramilitaries, without some degree of at least Pakistani blind eye turning, if not active complicity. It does show China in a very bad light. Here is China, a permanent member of the Security Council, a body supposedly dedicated to world security, faced with overwhelming evidence that Jaish Mohammed were guilty of these murders. After all, they claimed the attack and still refusing to designate its leader.
I mean, why would China think its relationship with Pakistan is that sensitive, though? Is it not possible for China to say, we remain an ally and a partner of Pakistan, but, you know, Masood Azhar is a wrong'un by anybody's definition, and we're perfectly happy to blacklist him?
This is what makes it so much worse. Yes, of course it would be possible for China to do that. That's what grown-ups do. China has simply decided that its relationship with Pakistan is more important than its vital role as a permanent member of the Security Council. It's very sad.
Presumably, though, there is going to come a time when China seeks a similar sanction against some real or imagined militant organisation among the Uyghur people.
Yes, it'll be interesting to see whether any chickens come home to roost at that point, won't it? The Chinese tend to have a rather sort of, so we say, selective view of these things. You're a terrorist if you attack China. If you happen to be a terrorist protected by one of China's allies, you're probably a freedom fighter.
Moving along to another story from China, and this is, it's interesting. We will be speaking either tomorrow night or early next week to James Griffiths, author of a book about the Great Firewall of China. In fact, it's called that. And he does sort of delineate between what China censors and what it doesn't censor, and what actual Chinese grievances and complaints are allowed sort of run free on social media. And this is one of them. This is a social media story. I mean, this is people getting quite reasonably outraged about a thing, but in this case, social media has been allowed to mobilise.
That's right. The thing being an incident in Chengdu No. 7 experimental school, which sounds like something out of the Gulag, doesn't it?
I'm not sure I'd send any children of mine to something called No. 7 experimental high school.
My views entirely. Nevertheless, this is a very reputable school. It's one of the top 10 Chinese private schools. And children were coming back from it over the last few weeks feeling just a little bit queasy. Now, you know, robust Chinese parents told them to stop whinging and get on and do their homework. But But last week, there was an incident at the school where the parents were invited for a tree planting, and a few parents decided to sneak off and go and look at the school kitchens and were disgusted with what they found. Squid, not refrigerated, just lying in cardboard boxes. Tripe, with kind of grey, smeary stuff all over it. Well, it's probably best not to know exactly what it was.
Tripe at the best of times, frankly, is I've got my doubts.
Yeah, I share those doubts, and this was not one of the best of times. Chestnuts just piled up on the unwashed floor. It's hardly any surprise that the kids were going sick. Parents, of course, outraged. The parents who got into the kitchen shared their photos. A great gang of parents then formed up outside the school gates and stopped two truckloads of rotten food that the school was trying to remove quickly in an effort to destroy the evidence. For their pains, the parents were assaulted by the police, 12 of them arrested, and accused of insulting public order. That's China for you.
Number 7 Experimental High School, we should note, is run by an outfit called First City Group Limited. This is the most dystopian-sounding thing I've ever heard of in my life.
Yes.
Well, on which subject? Moving along to a story from Channel News Asia. Joss Stone, the British soul singer playing in North Korea. I'm biting back very hard on any haven't they suffered enough variety punchlines here. I do quite like this idea that Joss Stone is pursuing. She is attempting to play a show in literally every country on earth. She took up this idea 5 years ago. She's 175 countries in. This is genuinely impressive.
It is genuinely impressive, and she's doing the tough ones. I mean, doing a concert in North Korea is no small thing. Now, she didn't manage to do a concert in front of a North Korean audience. That perhaps would have been too much to hope for. But she was allowed to sing in the cinema complex of the Yanggakdo Hotel, which is a kind of isolated hotel used purely for foreign tourists, to a select audience of foreign tourists, surprise, surprise, journalists, tour operators, and a few others. And the concert was, I understand, actually very good. Much more to the point, she then went and said hello to my successor, Colin Crooks, the British ambassador there, who got a selfie with her, which I'm insanely jealous, but there we are. That's life.
What is the awkwardness, as far as the North Korean authorities would see it, of allowing Joss Stone or indeed anybody else to play to North Koreans? Because there has been, at the very least, the case within the last couple of years of Laibach, the somewhat strange Slovenian rock group, going and playing in Pyongyang to actual North Koreans who seemed, frankly, no less bewildered than most of Laibach's audiences.
Laibach followed by Joss Stone. I mean, just how good can life get? Yes, there have been exceptions, and there have been a lot of South Korean exceptions. The détente between the two Koreas has brought about a few cultural exchanges. Nevertheless, the North Koreans in general remain deeply suspicious of anybody who might go off script and start to sing songs that they might not approve of. So they take the simple answer. They simply stop it happening at all.
John Everard, thanks as always for joining us. You're listening to The Daily on Monocle 24. And finally tonight on The Daily, the idea that the Fox News bloviator Tucker Carlson could be beset by scandal over resurfacing recordings of him saying crass, obnoxious and stupid things seems counterintuitive. Anybody wishing to hear Tucker Carlson saying crass, obnoxious and stupid things needs only to tune into his program. Nevertheless, there are those, including some Fox advertisers, affecting to be shocked at this week's exhuming by the watchdog Media Matters of Carlson's contributions a decade and some back to a radio show hosted by the prominent American conservative thinker Bubba the Love Sponge. Earlier, I spoke to the writer and editor Joanna Weiss. Joanna, to the tapes themselves first, these tapes that have been exhumed and re-released in the last few days, how bad are they? And I feel like I should add to that question the writer, how bad are they when compared to what Tucker Carlson says day in, day out on Fox News anyway?
Well, I think it's one of those things where the medium is the message. I mean, Tucker Carlson was on a shock jock show, so he was trying to do the things that people do when they're trying to mimic shock jocks. And usually people who are not professional at that kind of put their foot in it. They're fairly inelegant about it. So he said some things that I think in some ways even go beyond the kinds of things he says on the air, just really baldly misogynistic stuff that's just so obviously played for effect and doesn't really fit into a news channel as much as it would a morning radio show.
Well, you say obviously played for effect, and this, I think, is always the key question when talking about Tucker Carlson and other current and former Fox personalities. One thinks, obviously, of the likes of Sean Hannity and Bill O'Reilly. Where do we think the balance is between them saying things they actually think and just saying stuff they know plays with the audience because they're putting on a show and that's their job?
It's a tough one, and I think Tucker Carlson is a particularly perplexing case because in his history, over the course of his career, he's been a fairly thoughtful writer. I mean, he had a reputation as a pretty straight and narrow political journalist. Then he got caught up in TV, and it's a lucrative and exciting profession, and he did quite well in it. And over time at Fox, he just got more and more extreme. And people often comment on the disparity between the old Tucker they once knew and read and this new outrageous Tucker on TV every night.
The question that now arises following these revelations revelations of Tucker Carlson attempting to engage in badinage with the shock jock is, and it's a weird sounding question because it invites you to take on board the idea that Fox News at this point is embarrassable, but is this actually embarrassing for Fox News? Will the people at Fox see this as potentially damaging to its reputation?
It's hard to say because Fox has a real history of circling the wagons and protecting its own. And Tucker Carlson, you know, it has up until now done pretty well in the ratings. He's part of that voice of Fox that's been quite successful in the Trump era. And the idea that he's standing up against the liberal media, the mainstream media, and kind of putting himself up as a victim is very much in tune with the way Fox positions itself all the time.
Is that what Carlson himself has said about this?
Yes, and he's been very much on the offensive, talking about how he's the victim and also trying to dredge up Media Matters for America, which is the nonprofit kind of media watchdog, left-leaning media watchdog group that dug up these tapes and has been promoting them, you know, far and wide and very aggressively. The CEO of that group, Tucker Carlson, found some blogs that he wrote back in the day when he was allegedly, or, you know, he claims he was trying to do something satirical and said some fairly non-PC kind of offensive things. And so Tucker Carlson's trying to say, look, this guy does the same stuff. He's living in a glass house and he is hardly innocent.
So I guess the crucial question then becomes, as is often the case, a financial one. Are there any signs of Tucker Carlson's regular advertisers becoming nervous about this?
His show has lost a few advertisers, a mattress company called Sheeks, for instance. There are a few that have dropped, as a few advertisers have dropped the show of Judge Jeanine Pirro, who has said some fairly offensive things about a Muslim woman member of Congress. So there's a little bit. The big question comes this week because a lot of advertisers are being courted by Fox to purchase ads space moving forward. And if these concerns about the network really create a groundswell among advertisers, that could lead to some second guessing in the network.
Do we have any idea from either, I guess, current statements of Fox executives or Fox's past history, what it actually takes for Fox to give up on one of its marquee names? Because they have done it, of course, most obviously in the case of Bill O'Reilly.
Sure. And what happened in the case of Bill O'Reilly was that he cost the network a lot of money in the form of settlements from women who claimed that they'd been sexually harassed by him. So, yes, when the bottom line becomes a real issue, I think that's when you're going to see Fox executives maybe starting to have a second look. Now, it is interesting to note that Rupert Murdoch's sons, who are slowly and steadily attempting to take the network, take control of the network over from him, they have a bit of a different stance than their father. They seem a little bit more inclined to be concerned about what the public thinks. And so they might ultimately be a little bit more attuned to advertiser pressure than their father has been.
Do we have any indication of how this is playing with Tucker Carlson's audience, or should we assume that if you're the kind of person who's broadly on board with Tucker Carlson anyway, this kind of thing probably isn't going to upset you all that much?
I think you're right. I think Fox does tremendously well with making its audience feel like it's on the same team and it's us against the rest of the world. Fox has created, with so many of its shows, a kind of a clubby atmosphere and this feeling that viewers and the host are kind of in it together. And they're the ones who are sort of standing on the hill with the rest of the world around them and against them.
So how do you see this playing out? Are there suggestions that there's more of this stuff where the stuff we've already heard came from?
Well, Media Matters says that it's got a lot more information, a lot more tapes, and that they're ready and willing to start continue to dole it out. So we'll see. You know, the thing is, just like Donald Trump, who says outrageous things every day, there reaches a point when maybe each new outrageous statement or outrageous tape dug up has the effect of kind of diminishing returns. It's unclear, you know, people know what they know now about what Tucker Carlson has done and said. Whether any new piece of information is going to change anyone's mind is an open question.
That was Joanna Weiss speaking to me earlier, and that is it for today's edition of The Daily. It was produced by Mark Osipi and Augustin Macellari. The researchers were Ben Ryland and Nick Moniz. Our studio manager was Sarah Miles. The Globalist is here 8 hours from now with Tadhg Enright. The Daily is back at the same time tomorrow. I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening.